Hey everybody, it's your Podsman Josh, aka what is my nickname, Matthew? It's been so long.
It's something to do with your feet, I think.
Bucket foot.
That's it.
And you are our man, Matthew Sweetbread Rothfuss, coming to you here late in 2020. Good to hear your voice, Sweetbread.
It's good to hear yours as well, Buckafoot. We snuck it in, didn't we?
We got it in under the wire. We've been, like everyone else, distracted with a million and one things. It's been a weird year. But we are excited to wrap up the 2020 season. And I feel like I want to cover the 2021 season. I'm optimistic. I say that now, you know? And I want to do some off-season takes, too, because there is a lot of interesting off-season activity happening in the 1920 baseball world. But before we get into that, let's just wrap the 1920 season. So when we last left you, there were 10 games left in the regular season. The Black Sox investigation was just getting really started. The White Sox players, there had been some admissions of guilt. And the on-the-field action, though, was still really interesting. There was a pennant race heating up. And so let's go ahead. Do you have it there in front of you, Sweetbread? You can give us the final.
I do. Yeah. So yeah, we did leave off with about 10 games to go, I think. And there was a little bit of a pennant race in both, especially in the American League. So we'll start there. So I think the Indians were about a half game up on the White Sox when we left off. And we had discussed about how the implications of these White Sox players that were implicated and also, I think, confessed.
And suspended, right?
So what ended up happening is with a few games to go, I think with like a 1-3-game series left or something, the Comiskey banned quite a number of players, or didn't ban them, but benched them, basically.
Suspended them, yeah,
thank you. And not that would have changed anything, but really up until the end of the season, it may have really affected the their play, of course.
Were they in second place, Indians, or were they in third place?
The White Sox were a half game out when we did last episode. So that was 10 games to go. And all the news kind of came down. So, you know, whether or not they were on the field, I think we can probably assume that it had a big mental effect on the team, right?
Absolutely.
So they ended up, the Indians ended up winning the American League by a slim margin of 2 games. So it really did come down, I think, to that last weekend.
Yeah.
And again, who knows what would have happened. The Yankees were 3 out. So the White Sox were 2 out, the Yankees were 3 out. So the Indians are in the World Series, of course, in 1920. Only one team makes the playoffs from each league. And then in the National League, we had that 5-game lead by the Brooklyn Robins with 10 games to go. They must have shorted up pretty soon after, because they ended up winning by 7 games over the Giants.
And just to remind everybody, the Brooklyn team would become the Dodgers. They were named for their manager, William Robinson, right? Yeah. So they were the Brooklyn Robins at the time. Team names were, of course, kind of fluid and more like nicknames at this time. It's kind of the end of that era. But
yeah, I think a lot of them we discovered were their official names were just something like the New York baseball team, you know, the Boston National Baseball Team, something like that. And the nicknames weren't going to become official until later.
Hey, and it's a slight side note, but it's interesting here in 2020 to note that the Indians aren't going to be the Indians anymore.
No. I guess that's still up for debate. And what they'll
be like the Washington football team. They're just going to be nameless.
Yeah. So
I think they're going to name them. Some old timey baseball fans were like pushing for the team name to be the Spiders.
I think that would be great. That's we can all respect the Spider as a majestic animal and
cool name.
Yeah, cool name. I don't think there's any other spiders in the higher pro sports that I can think of.
No, there's a college basketball team I can think of, the Richmond Spiders. But the Cleveland Spiders were really bad. Like they were an era of Cleveland baseball history that is if you're a baseball historian, you're like, ugh, why would we want to be why do we want to bring back the Spiders? They were so bad. But it's a cool name. So yeah, that's my vote.
Yeah, I'd be like the Yankees bringing back the Highlanders when they were so bad, right?
Yeah.
So
Highlanders does sound cool though.
It does.
My suggestion for the Cleveland team name is the Cleveland Whippets. Like, because the Whippets are a dog, and also Whippet the song by Devo, because Devo is the greatest rock band from Ohio. They're from Dayton or Akron. Devo is from Akron, Ohio. But I think that the Cleveland Whippets sounds awesome. I also realize there's a drug implication that people might not be super on board with. But it's a dog, which I love dogs, and I love Devo, and it's Cleveland, it's Ohio. No one's answering my calls, by the way, when I call the front office.
So those are your kind of the – I won't give you the full standings. You can
Back to 1920.
But, yeah, I think what we can establish – we'll put the official suggestion in to the Cleveland baseball team.
I've called
them. Okay, all right. We're already there.
Oh, yeah. So the Robins end up running away a little bit with the NL. The Indians end up squeaking into the – AL. And of course, it's so interesting to look back at this end of the year, because if you remember in the very beginning of the year, Cleveland had been close, but not quite for a number of times in recent history, 1920 history. They were a baseball mad city for sure, the whole country, of course, but Cleveland was fanatical and the team was so close. And then in the beginning of the year, we read that article where it really seems like If this was a movie, you'd be like, that is like hackneyed writing, because it's that interview with Chris Speaker, who was the star and the manager, and the reporter was just laying it on, just saying how sun shines every day in the Cleveland spring training. Like, it was all sunshine and smiles. Like, it was so, they were so optimistic and so riding so high. And then, of course, the most unbelievable tragic incident, which is the on-field death of their star shortstop, Ray Chapman, who was hit in the head with a pitch. And this is, of course, the darkest possible turn that a team's season could take, never mind the standings. This is a young man's life that was taken in front of their eyes in the most traumatic way. And then to go from that to then be in a really close pennant race, and then what must have seemed like divine intervention, all the White Sox stars get benched or suspended because of the gambling. And then the Indians are able to sneak in and win the pennant and go to the series to try to fulfill that preseason promise of sunshine and smiles. The first interesting thing I noted about the 1920 World Series is that it's a 9-game series, best of 9, right?
Yeah. I think that practice was going to last for a few more years. I don't know when they changed it again.
But it was a short-lived aberration in the World Series history, a 9-game series. But it didn't go to a full 9, did it?
No, I think it only went 7. And I was just going to say, I think in our research, and I guess this is just common sense, I think the decision that to go 9 was probably monetary, right? Because I think the majority of their revenue at the time was from ticket sales, right? You know, pre-television contract era. Pre-merchandising too, for the most part.
Sure, absolutely. I think radio started a little, like maybe even the next year in the early 20s, okay. The first radio broadcast of baseball. But yes, this was, yeah, makes sense. Might as well, if you're going to sell out 7 games, might as well sell out 9 games. Big money. But yeah, this game went to how many games? This series went to
7. Yeah.
And so we can reveal now that the Indians did fulfill their promise. They won the series, I think, 5 games to, I think the Robins got 2 wins. And the Speaker-led Indians were crowned victorious. And I know that in game 5, there was a truly remarkable occurrence that I think you wanted to share a little bit of information about?
Yeah, so game five still has not happened before or since. In the fifth inning, Cleveland was playing defense and Brooklyn was up. There was nobody out, runners on first and second. And a line drive was hit up the middle. The second baseman, Wams Gans.
Yeah, Wams Gans.
Second baseman. Maybe he was the shortstop, actually.
Was he though? I mean,
no, he was the second baseman. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Shortstop was Chapman's replacement, Dugan.
It might have been Sewell, or it might have been because Sewell has had those defensive.
Yeah.
Right? He ended up being a third baseman eventually. It might have been Harry Lunte.
Yeah, they moved around a bit.
Yeah, or Les Nunemaker. So yeah, line drive up the middle, nobody out, by Clarence Mitchell. Wham's Gams, I guess he probably was either playing him, you know, up the middle.
Trying to maybe hold the runner on.
For double play, right? Yeah, playing up the middle. So he catches the ball, he steps on second base, and then he tags out the runner coming from first for an unassisted triple play.
First and only unassisted triple play in World Series history.
And I don't have the stats in front of me, but I don't think there's been too many unassisted triple plays in Major League history, have there?
Just a handful. I saw one on the Phillies, of all people, Eric Brundtland turned one. The Phillies, a reserve infielder. I remember that game. Eric Brundtland is the answer. He's the answer to two Phillies trivia questions. Or am I wrong? Didn't he turn one?
No, he probably did. I mean, let me look here. Yeah, Eric Brundtland, 2009.
He's the answer to two Phillies trivia questions because he scored the winning run in the 08 World Series also. And he also turned on an assisted triple play. Otherwise, very forgettable player.
But, so according to this, and again, I don't know how early they've kept these stats or kept an eye on it, but according to this, this is the second, okay, in the modern era, this is the second unassisted triple play in Major League history, in the first or the second in the modern era.
Which was Brundtland's?
I'm sorry, the Wham's Gans.
Wham's Gans. Oh, I see. Yeah. So since then, we've probably had a handful of them. But that is amazing, and that is obviously helped turn the tide of Game 5. Earlier in that game, Elmer Smith of the Indians hit a grand slam. That was the first grand slam in World Series history, off of our man Burley Grimes, old stubble beard. So that gave the... That game, the Indians were obviously up by a bunch, but an unassisted triple play clearly helped preserve a victory. And then Jim Bagby, who was the pitcher for the Indians, also hit a home run. So they got a three-run dinger by their pitcher, a grand slam by Elmer Smith, and they won, and an unassisted triple play. So that was a big victory. That was game five. That was 8-1. The Indians won. And then they ended up putting it to bed in game seven.
So, yeah, it looks like other than, the Robins won, what, game two and game three. But it really was a pitching duel for most of the series, right? Really, other than this game, wasn't a lot of runs scored. And our man from, again, I'm going to mispronounce this, Shumhokin?
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 I always say Shumhokin, but I don't know if that's right.
And that's Stan Kovaleski, right? He looks like he was the star of this series.
I don't think they gave out like individual awards like that, right? Like they didn't really give out like
maybe
like a series MVP or anything.
I don't think.
But he might have been the one. He might have done it, huh?
Three wins and 27 innings pitched, so three complete games. And gave up a total of two runs. So quite a accomplishment.
Speaking of individual achievements, before we catch up on our season-ending Sisler watch, I think that despite how much we love the Sis and what a great year he had, I mean, there's no way you can't give the MVP of the season to Babe Ruth. I mean, you know, we baseball nerds talk about the bold print, like when you're looking at a player's BB reference page, every time they led the league in a category that it's bolded. So like when you're looking for a player to say like, oh, do they have a Hall of Fame case? Sometimes people will say, well, there's not any bolds. You know, they've never led the league in anything or, you know, whatever. But Babe Ruth's whole career is bold. I mean, almost. And his 1920, he led the league in runs. Obviously, 158. A lot of those drove himself in. But he led the league in runs. He led the league in home runs, 54. He led the league in RBIs with 135. He led the league in walks with 150. He led the league in OBP at 532. He didn't lead the league in batting average, but he did hit 376. He led the league in slugging, of course, with 847, OPS, OPS plus. I mean, we're just talking about a 376 batting average with 54 home runs and 532 on base percentage. We are talking about one of the all-time seasons. I mean, his year where he hit, the following year he hits 59 home runs. And of course his 1927 season, he hit 356 and had a 60 home run season that stood for so long. But if you want to try to say like, which was his best offensive season of his career, it still might be this 1920 season. You know, OPS plus adjusts for you relative to the league. So that's his highest single OPS plus year. So OPS isn't like, I don't know. I've heard a couple of baseball nerds talking about how it's not a perfect stat because of, I mean, it kind of counts things twice, but it's still not a bad shorthand to say. I mean, and that is by quite a margin his best OPS plus year.
It's adjusted for players' ballpark. I wonder how that factors in. We'll have to look into it.
Yeah, any of the plus stats, essentially just they try to normalize it for various factors, right? Yeah, so
when we were trying to normalize our NARs, right? Our Nicholas replacement.
Do we have a NAR plus? Yeah. Because if you have a cool nickname now, it's worth more than if you had a cool nickname in 1920. That's a good point. Because nicknames themselves are less cool overall.
Yeah. Mm.
You raise an interesting point.
We'll have to revisit that. Yeah.
Was this the highest single season OPS of Ruth's career? It was 1920. He had a higher on-base plus slugging in 1920 than even he did in his historic 1927 year. I think this might have been the year with his highest on-base career. No, he is on base in 1923, which also was a very good year. His on-base percentage that year was 545.
According to this, he is number one all-time in OPS plus. Want to guess who number two is?
Is this, so you mean this season or his career?
I'm sorry, career. I just did a quick Google search and I found OPS all-time.
Ruth has the highest OPS plus. Oh, I don't know, Barry Bonds?
He's three. Barry Bonds is three.
Ted Williams?
Yes.
Ted Williams. Can't forget Ted. What I wanted to look up real quick is, just because it's kind of interesting, how many walks he had that year. I guess they didn't track intentional walks. On Baseball Reference, you can't see how many times he was intentionally walked. But he was walked 150 times that season. But in 1923, he was walked 170 times, and he hit 393. No wonder his
MVP was. I think that might have been his best year, and they won it all that year too.
23 was.
Yeah, and I think that was the year that he had a big World Series as well. But I could be wrong.
And it looks like a down year because he only had 41. I say only one, but only 41 dingers was relatively low for his run that he was on here. But if you hit 393 with 41 home runs and 170 walks, I mean, that is ridiculous. I don't have to tell you. That is a ridiculous season. His best year for total bases was actually 1921. He had 457 total bases. That's a wild year.
That's insane.
Yeah, because he had 388 total bases in 1920, which he hit 54 homers. He hit five more dingers in 21, so he hit 59. He must have had a bunch of doubles that year, too. Yeah, he had.
He took a peek at Sisler's total bases in 1920. He had 399, and I thought that was pretty insane. Well,
especially because it's mostly singles.
He had 49 doubles and 18. Oh,
wow, that is more. Yeah. But here's a crazy number: in Ruth's 1921 season, he had 16 triples.
He had some speed when he was.
That's more. That's his league. That's his career high in triples.
And of course, he had his deep valleys too. But yeah, I mean, triples were a lot more common back then.
They had 16 triples, 59 homers, 44 doubles.
I pulled up the adjusted OPS, and I found something really funny here. So the number one, two, and three is all Barry Bonds in his, you know, bizarre run of
superhuman
and walks and dominance in the early 2000s. Number four is a relative of somebody we know. Can you believe this? Do you remember who we talked about at some point? I think. Yeah, he's come on the podcast, and this is, I guess, one of his ancestors.
Oh, our man Josh Gibson?
No. Somebody that we actually work with.
Wait, David Dunlap?
David Dunlap has an ancestor.
I thought you were going
to about this. Yes, Lefty Dunlap has an ancestor that was a very good baseball player.
We haven't confirmed that they're related. We just kind of pretend.
All right. Okay. We'll have to confirm, but we're just going to, for the sake of, Hollywood's sake, but,
sure.
Fred Dunlap in 1884 had a 256 OPS plus. I can't see it. Yeah. So there you go, Lefty.
That's higher than Ruth's 1920 season.
Yeah.
How did he do it?
Let me see. 1884, he had 160 runs, 412 batting average. A lot of these stats, they don't really have, everything full. Right. Stolen base.
What year was that again?
1884.
There's definitely some fluke years in that era, but that's amazing. Where'd it go? Sure Shot. His nickname was Sure Shot. He was known for
St. Louis Maroons. So.
Oh, yeah. I love the Maroons as a team name. I mean, I just think
that's. Right. Well, is that the team name that got stripped of the NFL title, right? The Pottsville, was that the Pottsville Maroons?
I think you're right. That's cool.
Story too.
So let me hit you up with our end of year Sisler watch. George Sisler, of course, we've been following his ups and downs of the whole year. His downs were not many, but there was some question as to whether or not he would finish the year hitting over 400. And just for a little bit of drama, I'll back you up to September when he was hitting a lowly 396. And then he got hot. Four-hit game, three-hit game, two-hit game, three-hit game, two-hit game. That's a stretch right there. Multi-hit games, one, two, three, four, five games in a row. And then he had another three-hit game. And so the average gets all the way up to 407, which is where it ends at the season. Let's hear it. Let's hear it from Bruce Sisler. 407 leads the league in hitting. Wait, does he? That is a good question. We gotta look at the.
Right? He had the number one. He is first in hits.
He's the number one, Sisler. Yeah, he led the league in hitting. Obviously, 407. He did lead the league in total bases also because he was actually up from. So he had 399 total bases. How many did we say Ruth had?
I think he had like 380 something.
That's amazing. Yeah. So he had a better total bases number than his AL counterpart, Babe Ruth. The MVP award wasn't given out. And then for a period of time, you could only win it once, which is odd. Because like Ruth would have had a number of MVP years, but you could only win it one time for a reason. But Sisler does win the MVP in 1922 when he has, talk about a Sisler watch, that's the year he hits 420. I don't know if I even knew that. Did you know that George Sisler hit 420 in 1922?
I did not. No.
Wow.
Is that the highest average since then? We'll have to look into that. Yeah.
Good question. Sisler was as great as we thought he would be. Ruth was as great as we thought it would be. The Indians overcome the death of Ray Chapman.
Yeah, I think, and I think Sisler really doesn't get enough. He doesn't get enough love, right? I mean, we talk about all the great first basemen of all time, and you know he's gotten a lot of love this year, but
yeah, I'm still. I agree with you, and he also was historically relevant because of his connection to Branch Rickey and his role in bringing Jackie Robinson or scouting Jackie Robinson anyway. So Sisler worked as a – so Branch Rickey was Sisler's college coach and at Michigan. And then they worked together years later in the Dodgers organization. And Sisler was part of the scouting team that that found Jackie Robinson. And then Sisler's son was a major league player also. If you read The Old Man and the Sea, the Hemingway book, of course, the guy from the what's his name? Santiago, the Cuban fisherman who's the star of that story, he talks about reading the baseball scores and he talks about DiMaggio and he talks about Sisler. And I was like, you know, just like, it was so interesting to see the name. And then I was like, wait, that's a whole generation later. Turns out, I think that was Dick Sisler, George's son. So there is a Sisler shout out, albeit a different Sis, in one of the great American works of literature. He was a tangential part of the great, historical watershed moment of American history with Jackie Robinson. And, you know, you could swing the stick a little bit too. So let's hear it for George Sisler. Good way to, good note to go out of our 1920 on. Another thing to sort of, to really interesting to circle back to one of our very first podcasts was when we talked about the formation of the National Negro League with Rube Foster in 1920. And then we were fortunate enough to interview Sean Gibson, who is the grandson of the great Josh Gibson. What was his team? Pittsburgh Crawfords?
Yeah.
And he's the, Sean is the head of the Josh Gibson Foundation, and we talked to him about the possibility of the Most Valuable Player Award being renamed for Gibby, and then also about the all-time stats. So give us some updates on what's going on in the world of those things.
So a few weeks ago, the Major League Baseball came out and said that we are going to officially recognize Negro League stats. So previously they were unofficial records that weren't integrated into, I guess, Major League Baseball has editions and official records. It's not a perfect science because there was a lot of loosely attached, kind of schedules and seasons and games, and whether or not they're officially recognized as being, an official Negro National League game, or if they're just considered like an exhibition game, is kind of subjective kind of thing that they have to look at a case by case basis. So it's a lot of work that goes into it. So one of the things that was discussed is something that we discussed with Sean earlier this year was Josh Gibson's home run record. So even though it's widely considered that Josh had an incredible amount of home runs in his lifetime, the Major League is not going to be recognizing him as the home run leader because they only recognize a surprisingly low figure of 238. Considering what we've heard as the official home run total for his career.
What? Yeah, that's low. Yeah. Come on. I'm not mad at you.
We'll be finding out more and more information here as this goes along. Because I think this was just announced about 2 weeks ago, right? So I'm sure they'll be, they're hard at work looking at a lot of this stuff. But it, you know, it leaves a lot up to debate and stuff, so which is kind of great.
Yeah, there's no doubt that the early years of what we know as Major League Baseball are, the boundaries are not nearly as clear as we might imagine with how we think about the modern world. So, but that's cool anyway. No matter anything that gives props to the great ball players of the Negro League is cool with me. And I did also hear that, aren't they removing Landis's name from the trophy?
Yeah, that was a little bit older news, but I think we learned that as well, right?
I don't think we talked about it on the pod, though. I mean, Kennesaw Mountain Landis, who we feel, I don't know, I'm going to speak for you. We feel like his legacy is complicated more than it is simple.
There's the assumption that he is a southern boy, right, so to speak.
I mean, he's named Kennesaw
in the South, but yeah, but he's actually named for the battle that his father died in. He was, I think, Ohio,
right?
Yeah, and he was heavily involved with the Progressive Party, and he served under I think Theodore Roosevelt. So you know, he doesn't come from necessarily a, I don't know how to put this. Maybe he comes from more of a progressive background than people assume that he does.
And he was the commissioner, he was the first commissioner, but he was also the last commissioner of segregated baseball. So if you just look at that as a single.
Yeah, we don't want to be apologists for him, obviously. No, everybody can make better decisions, I think.
Right, if you consider that he was the last commissioner of over segregated baseball, then you're like, well, yeah, why should we be honoring this guy at all? There's not a ton of evidence to support that he was like, he's not like a purely like evil figure who was like completely opposed to segregation. He also didn't welcome it, it seems, or he definitely didn't like. He wasn't like
that. I think there was at least one story about him handing down some serious discipline for racism, or not, you know, not necessarily overt racism, but an incident with a black ball player that was, and again, I might be remembering this, but there was an incident with some white ball players versus, American person, and he handed down some pretty swift justice.
He sided on the he punished the racists. Yeah, he was on the side of justice in that case anyway. So yeah, I do sound like a Landis apologist. I'm not. I don't want to be, and I don't even care. Like if his legacy is complicated, so what? That he's if the symbolism is he was the representative of the segregation era, get rid of his name. I don't care.
Like exactly. And it sounds like there's just not enough information to really know. And
you know, he was an important figure in baseball history. He obviously came in at the time of the, you know, during the Black Sox scandal when gambling was really and the lack of clear leadership and was really threatening the future of organized baseball. So he did play an important role, but a historical role doesn't mean we need to put his name on the MLB MVP award. Why not give it to someone like Josh Gibson, who was a great actual player and who overcame racism instead of benefited from it, you know?
So exactly. And I think the argument too should be more about Josh Gibson's accomplishments and not Landis's downfalls, or you know, and again, it should be a player too. I think it should be named after a player.
So the first step anyway did occur, and I did talk to Sean over email after that was announced, that the sort of first step of Landis's name officially coming off the trophy was done. It doesn't mean it's being replaced with Josh or anyone else, but it does mean that Landis's name is no longer officially on the MVP trophy. So I think that's a step for progress, and I think recognizing these stats is a step for progress. I mean, I kind of think both things probably were because of this podcast.
Definitely. We have a lot of Yeah. So, John,
we have a lot of sway in the
listening. Yeah.
Manfred's office. They listen all the time. They love it. Well, I am excited to still follow the off season goings on. The I know you have some takes on the Black Sox scandal that we're going to get into at a future episode. I do want to do a couple more player profiles too, where I just highlight some individuals who I think don't get the love that they deserve.
And yeah, we got to do our tea kettle. What did we name it last year? Hot tea kettle.
Yeah. Well, our preseason, instead of the hot stove, it was the tea kettle takes. The era appropriate terminology of the tea kettle. So we'll do some tea kettle takes in the off season, and we'll look ahead to the 1920 season. There's so many, any week that we drop into the 100 years ago newspaper archives, there's a cool baseball story without exception. So we are sorry that we dropped the ball in the final weeks of the 1920 season, but we're glad to have shared this with our listeners, and I'm glad to have dived into this interesting season with you, Sweet Bread.
Definitely, Buckethead. It's been a lot of fun.
And we'll be back on the air sometime soon. So look for, Tea Kettle Takes and more coming to you on This Week in 1920s Baseball.
Later.